Now, what will we find at the very center of our planet? Our understanding continues to evolve with some new research about the ways that earthquakes reverberate through the Earth. When I learned about the planet's layers, I thought of the Earth as having four: a thin rocky crust, then a mantle underneath that can move the crust around. Beneath that, you got an outer core of liquid metals, followed by a solid inner core. But hang on, scientists from Australian National University say they've confirmed a different layer at the very center of our planet, almost 4,000 miles down from where we're standing, or sitting. Eva Golos is an assistant professor in the Department of Geoscience at UW-Madison. Eva, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about how researchers used earthquakes and the waves they sent around the world to figure out what is at the very center of the Earth?
Yeah. So what seismologists do when they're studying things like the deep Earth structure is actually pretty similar to medical imaging. So if you've ever heard of or ever had a CAT scan or an X-ray, it's similar to that. So we have seismometers, which are instruments that record the shaking from earthquakes. And wherever an earthquake happens, if it's strong enough, the waves can travel all around and all through the center of the Earth and can be sensed in that seismometer. So we can do a bunch of different signal processing to figure out what that structure is. But the deeper you go, the deeper you want to look, the harder it is to find those waves that pass through the center of the Earth. So that's one thing that makes this study really cool.
Is it a matter of, you know, if we've got more seismometers around the planet, we can start to get better and better deep readings like that?
Yeah, exactly. One of the big problems with that is that it's a lot easier to put seismometers on land. So we're a little bit limited on where we can place our instruments, but there are more efforts to instrument the oceans as well, which is exciting. But even with data that we already have, there's always new ways to look at it and new ways to use what we have to learn as well.
So what is this telling us is at the very center, the core of the core, I guess?
I guess at the center of the core is another core. So the study gets, I would say, a little bit technical in this regard. So some of the layers, for instance, the mantle versus the core, are very different in composition, in state. The outer core is iron and nickel. It's liquid, whereas the mantle has a different composition and is more or less solid. The inner core is all solid. It's all iron. The difference is really the structure. So it's mostly iron. And what scientists noted was a property that we call anisotropy. And what that means is that waves that travel in different directions through a medium will travel at different speeds. So what the authors of this study noticed was that waves that travel through the outer part of the inner core are faster in one direction and slower in another direction. And that same thing is the case in the innermost inner core, but that direction that they travel more quickly in is different in the inner core. So it's sort of two shells within a single layer that we can study using these really powerful seismic waves.
Now, you also do research based on seismic waves. I think you've got projects going in Alaska, for example, where they have more earthquakes than we do here in Wisconsin, which is part of why I'm in Wisconsin. What kind of work, what are you, and you're looking a little further up than the core. What kind of things are you looking for?
So my area that I focus on is in the crust and the uppermost part of the mantle. I really look at the scale of tectonic plates. We call that layer the lithosphere, which is the rigid layer at the surface, and that is composed of blocks that slide around and interact with one another. So we can use, I would say, a similar approach to this study of the core to look at the mantle, but we use different waves that don't travel quite as deep. And we can put seismometers in different places and look in significantly more detail. We're not as dependent on having these very unique ray paths. So what I'm doing in Alaska is I actually placed 11 broadband instruments with the help of some of my colleagues. What broadband instruments mean, they're seismometers that can listen to events that happen all over the world. They're powerful instruments. And they are right now sitting in the Kenai Peninsula of Alaska, a little bit south of Anchorage. And they're just listening and recording data constantly. And then we'll go there in May again, once all the snow has melted, and uncover our instruments, because some of them are buried under the snow, and take a look at the data. And what we're trying to do is image this layer of the lithosphere in greater detail. Alaska is a place where it's really important to understand that structure, because there are very large damaging earthquakes that can happen there. And we need to have a good picture of what the structure is in order to understand how shaking might happen in response to one of these big earthquakes.
So with a better map that you're hoping to generate with this gear you're going to dig out of the snow, we might be able to say this area might be more under more of a kind of threat than we might have thought previously based on the things we're seeing?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's the goal. That's the hope.
That I could see that being very practical. Getting back down to the core of the Earth, now I understand this is raising questions or maybe adding insight into why we have a magnetic field on the Earth and some about how our core formed. What kind of questions there sound interesting to you?
Oh, tons of questions. The core is super interesting. And you're totally correct that the core is ultimately the engine that drives the Earth's magnetic field. And really key to that is the outer core being liquid. You have liquid iron swirling around inside the outer core, and that ends up generating a magnetic field because it conducts an electric current. And so that is really the process that's responsible for the electric field. However, the outer core is slowly cooling. All of the Earth is very slowly cooling. And slowly the liquid outer core is starting to crystallize. It's starting to freeze because that liquid iron is getting cold. And that's what's forming the inner core. So the fact that we see a structural change in different portions of that frozen inner core might indicate something really interesting about the history of the Earth. You know, what kind of processes might have enough power to really change something at the very center? That's, I think, a really interesting question. Would we be able to make predictions about something we can test on the surface to better understand this process? Some people who are more familiar with the core might have interesting ideas about that, but I think it's a fascinating and important area to study in our planet.
Eva, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yep, thank you so much.
That's Eva Golos, assistant professor in the Department of Geoscience at UW-Madison. She joined us to look at new research that supports the theory of a solid metallic ball at the center of the Earth's core, a core of the core. Now, norovirus cases are on the rise. The CDC says that although cases are higher than this time last year, about 17% compared to about 15%, still within the expected range. But in some parts of the world, the gastrointestinal ailment has spiked. In the UK, cases are 66% higher than the average for this time of year. Norovirus is most common between November and April, usually peaks in the winter. We're talking about the current state of norovirus and what we can do to avoid getting it. Dr. Joseph McBride is an infectious disease specialist at UW Health. He treats complicated infections in adults and children, as well as infectious diseases related to organ transplants. Dr. McBride, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Can you give us the basics? What is norovirus? What can it do to us?
Yeah, the basics. You know, lots of times when we talk about different germs, we really go into the details of what the organism is first when we're describing it. But with norovirus, it's really best to get right to what the symptoms are, and because everybody really has their own norovirus story or recollection that they have. What norovirus is it's a really contagious gastrointestinal virus that comes on quickly usually in the matters of hours to a day or so after an exposure, and really ravages people with nausea, vomiting, fevers, body aches, chills. It goes away. For most immune competent people with healthy immune systems, it leaves oftentimes as quickly as it comes. But what it leaves is this really strong memory in people's mind about, boy, I remember that time I had that terrible gastrointestinal episode or stomach flu or outbreak at a certain center. And so people usually keep that memory with them for a while.
To what extent is it really a seasonal pattern of illness in Wisconsin?
Yeah. So like you mentioned it as the winter vomiting disease. Traditionally, it was thought of been really around November to April, like you mentioned. But we can see it throughout the whole year. And we'll call the ones in the summer kind of sporadic cases. Where we see the most episodes are during these winter months. So just like you might get a cold or flu season, we think of in the wintertime, but you can still get those things come summer. I would put norovirus in the same category.
How does it spread, this norovirus? And this is a little gross, but go for it.
Yeah. So norovirus is really an incredible virus because of just how easy it is to transmit from people to person to person, and also just how hardy it is. So just like you kind of alluded to, the most common way of it spreading is what we call fecal-oral route. So this would be someone who's got fecal matter on their hands, and then whether they then shake somebody's hand, touch a doorknob, cook food, this then gets spread to other individuals. But because norovirus is so hardy and so really resistant to kind of normal things like sunlight and temperature fluctuations, it can really stay on surfaces for a long time. And we call this fomite transmission. And, you know, I think we are a little bit heightened about these types of transmission in the setting of COVID these last few years. But this would be where you've got a viral particle that has been deposited on something and then somebody else touches it. And, you know, I think for listeners to hear just how kind of potent and durable these norovirus particles are, things like freezing it does not destroy the virus. Temperatures as high as 140 degrees Fahrenheit do not destroy the virus. Things like alcohol hand gel and different kind of alcohol-based cleaning products do not destroy the virus. And it can last on surfaces I mentioned for days. And so if you've got somebody in a setting of a big outbreak where it's running through a house or a college dorm or a cruise ship or a military barracks, you can really see how it's so easy for this to be transmitted around. And in fact, there is even reports of it being airborne after people throw up. So it's the idea that they're throwing up, the virus is up in the air, and it could be inhaled in that way. And so it is a very, very tough virus to avoid in the setting of a high outbreak situation.
I'm hoping you have some advice for us to help us not get and or spread this thing.
Right. Yeah. So the biggest thing is kind of what we've always known about is soap and water. So unlike those alcohol hand gels, this would be a situation in which I would really reach for soap and water over an alcohol hand gel, which are wonderful for a lot of respiratory viruses like COVID, but again, not for this. So if you're in a group of people where you could be touching a lot of things, I would always err on the side of soap and water. And if you happen to be a parent or a loved one caring for a sick individual with gastrointestinal symptoms, nausea, vomiting, be sure to use soap and water as kind of your cleansing habits. And similarly, if you were cleaning a bathroom, let's say of a symptomatic individual, bleach products, diluted bleach in water would be superior than kind of a lot of alcohol-based home cleaning products.
Okay, so oh no, we got it. What's the home care advice?
Yeah, diet it out is pretty much the best advice that we can give. You know, for somebody who's immune competent, healthy immune system, this will be a miserable few days. Most people are symptomatic for about 48 hours, and a few are a little bit longer than that. But you will get over it. Where people do run into trouble is when they are having such profound vomiting and diarrhea that they become dehydrated, in which case you really have to be sure you're keeping up with your fluids, especially in situations where you're not keeping stuff down. And if you find yourself in that situation and you're feeling like you're lightheaded than going out to seek medical care for maybe the need of IV fluids. Where we in infectious disease oftentimes see a lot of norovirus patients is in situations where maybe there is an immune compromising condition, like a solid organ transplant recipient or somebody with HIV or AIDS. And in these situations, symptoms do not oftentimes abate so quickly, and they can be persistent for weeks and months. And that is a really challenging thing because we do not have good antivirals to cure the infection.
And Dr. McBride, I mentioned, you know, this disease, it's here now. It's not in alarming levels in the United States at this point. What do you watch for to see if it's going to be a bad norovirus year?
Yeah, so there actually are national networks that track norovirus and other foodborne illness outbreaks throughout the country. The one specifically for norovirus is something called Norostat, which the federal government and CDC follow. And these are investigators who essentially go around and ask the questions of why did this large cohort of people get norovirus at this school or this hospital or this institution? And what they're able to do is follow numbers in many different states throughout the country to kind of give us a good sense. And here in Wisconsin, at least, I will say that the levels these last couple weeks are coming down a little bit from their high in early February. So we're hopeful that maybe we've weathered this storm and we'll be looking for, you know, smoother pastures, greener pastures in the next few months.
Dr. McBride, thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Dr. Joe McBride is an infectious disease specialist at UW Health. He talked to us about norovirus.